The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation is from David Fanning, journalist and founder of the PBS show Frontline.
When you're the executive producer of a program one newspaper called the most consistently important weekly hour on television, or another described as one of the most distinguished in television history, you can be certain you're one of the most important individuals in the history of television, perhaps even in the entire communications industry. Those are well-deserved plaudits that have been used to describe David Fanning, the executive producer of Frontline, since its first season in 1983. It remains America's longest-running investigative documentary series on television. Under David's leadership, Frontline has won all the major awards for broadcast journalism many times over. That includes 65 Emmys, 28 DuPont Columbia University Awards, 15 Peabody Awards, 11 Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Awards, and 8 Television Critic Awards. In 2004, Fanning received the Columbia Journalism Award, the highest honor awarded by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, with these words: David Fanning and his signature program, Frontline, have turned a commitment to probing journalism and public services into an enduring national conversation without which far too many important issues would remain veiled or hidden altogether. David began his filmmaking career as a young journalist in South Africa. He migrated to America in 1973 and began producing local and national documentaries for a PBS station in California. He moved to Boston in 1977 and started the development of Frontline in 1982. Before we welcome one of the giants in the world of communication today, David Fanning, let's take a brief look at 30 years of Frontline.
There really isn't anywhere else in journalism that does what we do. The issues that we began to wrestle with in the first season of Frontline are as vivid today as they were then.
Because two guns were kept in a bedroom drawer, ready and waiting, my granddaughter will be without a mother.
My daughter survived, but not before witnessing her friends and her teacher slaughtered in front of her.
We will always have miscarriages of justice. We will always have people in high places who abuse their power and reckless policies in far-off places.
Everybody knew what was happening in Rwanda.
It made no difference what you said or how you said it. The world just didn't care.
We believe people are curious, they're intelligent, that they want to understand these issues. We give voice to the moral dilemmas of our time.
People are there when the doors are open, and it makes it very uncomfortable. And I think it should be uncomfortable to kill your unborn baby.
Frontline represents the idea that we can take a path through this forest of information and draw a bright line through it and make sense of the world.
If there is a God, what is happening?
Frontline raised questions about the decision to go to war in Iraq within months of 9/11.
There are people in the State Department that referred to what is going on in the Pentagon as the cabal that is absolutely determined to lay the groundwork to get Saddam out with the use of American military troops.
We followed the troops into Baghdad. We stayed with the story through difficult times.
Garcia!
He went out fighting, and he died like he should.
Frontline looked at our armed forces coming home and the challenges they were facing. A group of men who were struggling upon their return from Iraq. They committed crimes. They wreaked havoc on their hometown. But somehow you couldn't look away.
I tried to kill myself by swallowing a lot of Seroquel and drinking some vodka. I thought that my time in this place was over and I'd already done what I was supposed to do. And I didn't want to live anymore.
Journalism is at its best when it tells the stories of people. And people you care about. And people you love to hate.
What do you have to say to the public? You're investors.
So is this easy money that you're making with Madoff?
Easy. Easy peasy.
The best of Frontline, you come into the beginning of a story thinking you know something and you come out the other end being surprised by what you found.
You just made it up?
Just telling them what they wanted to hear.
The central question we're always asking is why are things the way that they are? Why are banks in a situation in which the top people have never been prosecuted?
Clients know our activities and they understand what market making is.
Do you think they know that you think something is a piece of crap when you sell it to them and then bet against it? You think they know that?
A story of kids who are dropping out of high school.
You turn your back on me. You don't even appreciate what I do for you.
A story about immigration reform.
We're left with essentially enforcement on steroids, but that's all we're left with.
A child who doesn't have food on her table.
I'm hungry.
I know, so am I.
The people inside those stories that bring them to life into your living room, onto the web, onto your tablet. There are times we need to move quickly. In Egypt, where we felt like the people's voices needed to be out there. Reports undercover from Syria.
These people are back on the streets. They're absolutely fearless.
There's an openness to Frontline's journalism. We believe in allowing our audience and the people who come to our website to go see for yourself. What I feel is so expansive about the new world is how many different ways you can tell a story and bring in new audiences. Now more than ever, as news organizations across the country are closing down their investigative units, Frontline remains strongly committed to asking those tough and uncomfortable questions, questions that need to be asked.
That is as close to the mission of public broadcasting as I can imagine.
All I want is the truth now. Just give me the truth now.
This idea, this commitment, this mission is valuable to us as a country and to us as citizens. Television that is important for the future as much as it is for the present.
Welcome, David Fanning.
Thank you. Thank you, Sherry. Thank you, Lloyd, for inviting me. What a great honor this is. I was coming to a small club in Indiana, and I walked into a ballroom, and you're shocking me. I now have to take a deep breath and try to tell you a little bit about who I am and what I do and why I do what I do. And in a way, I feel a connection to where I first started in this country. I came first to this country on something called AFS, American Field Service. I had the misfortune of being picked up in South Africa and dropped in Newport Beach, California. In 1964, the Beach Boys were playing in the Rendezvous Ballroom, and all was right with the world. But I was invited in the first week of my high school class to go and to talk to the English AP class. And I walked in being quite sort of full of myself and whatever, and walked in and found that they wanted to talk about Cry the Beloved Country, the book they were reading. And I had to tell them that the searing novel about apartheid in South Africa was a book I'd never read, because I wasn't allowed to read it in South Africa. So I sat in the sun of Lido Isle, Newport Beach, and read about my own country, and had to try to go back and try to explain it to my classmates. And it began a process of trying to understand not just what was wrong about the country, but why it had evolved that way and what had happened, and who were the Afrikaners, the people I knew, and this government that I kind of had hardly really understood in that depth. And I think in that moment, in my own sense of self-discovery, I probably became a journalist. It was, I found when I went back to South Africa, went to university, and found myself drawn not into science, where I was supposed to go on scholarship, but into the student newspaper, that journalism was a kind of license to be curious. It was a place that could satisfy my curiosity about the world, a kind of calling that said you could call almost anybody up and say, could I talk to you? I'm a journalist. And they do, astonishingly. So I began a journey that took me, in fact, into journalism, but also in a curious way into this thing that I now do, these documentaries. You know, in South Africa in the 60s and in the early 70s, there was no television. The government didn't allow it into the country. So I'd never seen a documentary. When I made my first two documentaries, I went into Soweto with a borrowed camera and tried to figure out how to make this. But I was able to somehow cobble together, with some help and some encouragement, a film that the BBC bought. I went to London to re-edit it for the BBC. I found that London was, while it was a fascinating place to be at the BBC, it was very wet and full of Brits. And so one day, on a very rainy day in October of 1972, I announced very loudly in the club at the BBC, I think I'll go to California. And so I fled on a one-way ticket to Los Angeles, thinking I was going on to Hong Kong, actually. And I walked a few months or so after I got back to my old family in Newport Beach, I walked into the little public television station. And that was where I began my own education as a filmmaker, as a journalist, a kind of sense of self-discovery again of this thing that I do, this thing that I've spent my professional life making, which are these documentaries. It's been an enormous privilege. I am a child of public television. I believe deeply in its mission and in the idea of it, because it gave me this opportunity. I was invited to go to Boston in 1977 to start a series called World, an international documentary series. Out of that came the kind of idea, the genesis of a larger series. But along the way, while I was invited to come and to help executive produce a series, international series, I was itching to go and make films. I had, during the time earlier, I had had the experience of, you know, going out in the field and making films, and I took a chance to follow up on a story about a Saudi princess who had been killed in a parking lot in Jeddah. Pictures of her execution had been published in a British newspaper, and so a colleague and I went on a journey of discovery. We made a film called Death of a Princess that some of you may remember. The film actually challenged the orthodox story that this girl and her lover had been found guilty of adultery and had been executed under Sharia law. In fact, what we found out was that she had indeed been abandoned by her husband, a prince, and she'd fallen in love with a young man. He was the son of the Saudi ambassador to Lebanon. And the two of them had tried to run away together, and they'd been caught at the airport and taken back to her grandfather's palace, Prince Muhammad, King Khalid's elder brother. And in order to make a show of why he believed that these younger generations shouldn't behave this way, Prince Muhammad, who of course in his own life had been a great libertine, a man who traveled the capitals of Europe and Monte Carlo with women and money, decided that he would make a show of it. And so he had a public execution in this parking lot. She, because of her royal privilege, was shot in the head. He was badly decapitated. So we did we put the film together, and as the film came together and we were heading towards broadcast in both Britain and the U.S., it was broadcast in Britain the week before the U.S., and the Saudi ambassador to British ambassador to Saudi Arabia was kicked out of the country, and the Secretary of State in the U.S. began to put pressure on public television not to run the film. Mobil Oil took out a full-page ad in the New York Times saying that public television shouldn't run this film. We were, after all, accusing the king's elder brother not of doing something under Sharia law, but in fact of murder. This had been a badly done execution on the whim of a member of the royal family. So the great pressures were put on public television in that moment. Now, if you remember Mobil Masterpiece Theater, and I was sitting at WGBH, which produced Masterpiece Theater, so here we had our major sponsor, we had public broadcasting under pressure, and I went to a meeting with Henry Becton, then president, and Peter McGee, the man who had first hired me to come to WGBH, and we sat in Henry's office, and they said, are we okay with the journalism in this? And I said, we are. You can trust us. We've done the work, and it's we're right about this. And so Henry said, well, we think that because of all the pressures, in case PBS wavers, we've rented space on the transponder of the satellite, and we will put the film up out of Boston to the country. And in that moment, of course, I knew that I worked in the right place. The film went out. The sky did not fall. PBS went with it. And in fact, as Peter would later say, it put a chalk behind the wheel of public television. It said, we can do things under extraordinary pressures, the kind of pressures of commercial, political, that would normally make broadcasters crumble. So out of that, that was the genesis, if you will, of Frontline. 2 years later, I was asked to start Frontline, and we expanded world and became the series it's become now. It is an extraordinary privilege. Extraordinary privilege. Public television, not only and with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, support the first 3 years of the series, but has continued now, in 33 years later, to continue to support it. The privilege of being able to do these kinds of films at length and with some complexity is rare. At the time that Frontline started, there was a headline in an industry newspaper that said, the last best hope for the TV documentary. Because what had happened was that essentially the networks had given up on documentaries, and there was this program called 60 Minutes. And Don Hewitt had had the brilliant idea, of course, to do shorter stories between the commercials, and that became the model for the magazine program and became a great source of income to CBS. Very successful program. Everybody imitated it. And you remember all the imitations that came up. They were called 2020 and Dateline, and they were called West 57th, and they were called Day One, and they had all kinds of proliferation of magazine shows. And for a long time, we believed that their investigative work and some of their other work, even though it was mixed in with entertainment and celebrity profiles, would be television's contribution to journalism. But what happened was, in fact, something shifted in the way in which we measure television. And right at that time, we used to be able to say, well, these were the average audiences for the hour. Then we knew what the average audiences for the quarter hours were. But by the time these network news divisions were doing the magazines, they were measuring it minute by minute, and they could watch the audience come and go through certain sorts of stories. And I have a friend who's a very good investigative reporter, won all kinds of awards, and she was working at 2020, and she said she came in and pitched a really good, tough, environmental investigative story, and they said, well, we don't want to do that. That's a J story. She said, what do you mean? She said, oh, it's a J story. Oh, it's a journalism story. We don't do those. They did. They knew the celebrity profile would work. They knew that the hidden camera would work, perhaps in certain cases. But other than that, the stories began to sort of look like each other. And of course, what happens when you chase ratings is that you try to figure out what the audience wants. And the only way you know what the audience wants is you look at what they looked at yesterday. The trouble is the audience doesn't know what it wants. It only knows what it saw yesterday and was quite prepared to see something you could show it that you think is important. But that decision was taken out of the internal editorial mechanism of television. And what happened was those shows disappeared. and they became true crime stories on Dateline, and 60 Minutes is a kind of not quite the series it once was, I think, in many ways, and is still successful in large part because of its placement, but also because there's been a general abandonment across all the networks of this kind of work. So there's been this fantastic commitment by public television to making of these films. These films take a while to make. You know, they take 6 months, 9 months to make. You set out to do them, and you have to do the research. You have to find a journalist who you can work with. The producers need to get up to speed. You spend a lot of time in research. You go out and film. And these days, with digital technology, we can shoot interviews that run for 3 or 4 hours. People come back with 30 or 40 interviews. They sit in a room with transcripts for all of those interviews and try to weave a tale out of it. The great high-wire act of making one of these films is that you're trying to do something that is about an issue of public interest. It's journalism. It's eat your spinach, okay? And you've got to also, at the same time, keep an audience and try to get them to watch it. This is a theatrical event, after all. You open up a curtain and say, here's a tale I'm going to tell you for the next hour. Stick with me, please. Shakespeare knew the problem, right? You know, get somebody up to say, this will be the tale we're going to tell you. Here's the prologue, and then let's go into act one. All films, by the way, have 3 acts. Sometimes 5 acts if they get really big, and they always have a new prologue and an epilogue, and they always start with Once Upon a Time. But you do need to impose a kind of dramaturgy on it. And so in doing that, you have to do something very complicated, which is to both tell a narrative and also put all the pieces that matter in the right places that both serve the narrative and also serve the public interest. And that's the great art and craft of it. Now, it is a great privilege to make these. We used to make them, we do make them, in great detail. You know, you get into the edit room, and Frontline's great gift, I think, is that it's an editorial process, that the producers who've worked through their material also know that they can only be as truthful and as honest as we believe them to be. And that means that at times you look at the footage with some care. I mean, this is the most manipulatable of media. You can take words and music, and you can change them and shift them. You can take what somebody said and put it a little bit backwards, or put it in a slightly different order, or take a question over here and take an answer from over there and put them together, and no one will know unless somebody is sitting in an edit room and say, can I see the rest of that, please? Can I see the rest of the transcript? We actually have somebody who sits with the transcripts in our online who looks at the film and goes through it. We have fact checkers that go through. We have a long tradition of green eyeshadows and blue pencils that sit through the line-by-line scripts and pictures of Frontline. That's because we've been given the privilege by public broadcasting of a kind of time and the kind to not only think about hard about what we're doing, but to rethink it and to re-edit it if we need and to go back and shoot more and do the rest of it. So you make all of these films, and then one night, you know, at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night, you pick it up and it's like a beautiful cabinet. Each one of these is a sort of intaglio and all the kind of, you know, beautiful joinery in it, and then you take it and throw it in the air. Some of it hits the satellite and comes back, and the rest goes to Mars. That was it. You know, we lost it all. It was gone. 1995, we were making a film about Waco. It's called Waco, The Inside Story, and we had found, it was a great journalistic coup, we'd got audio tapes of the FBI negotiations with David Koresh. I remember sitting in my office with a group of people and saying, well, this is wonderful, we have 30 seconds here and 45 seconds over there in the film, but we've got all the rest of this fascinating, you know, there were these great arguments between the ninjas and the negotiators. You know, the FBI ninjas wanted to go in and break it down, and the negotiators were, you know, trying to keep negotiating. And can we do a radio show with this? And they said, well, the radio isn't good enough, but somebody piped up, and I will give credit to the intern, who's nameless, said, you can put it on the web. And we said, really? So I said, what do you mean? He said, well, there's something called Real Audio. You can put it up. I said, really? What else can we put up? Well, you can put up the script. Well, can I put up the... Well, I can't put up the interviews, but I could put up the transcripts of the interviews. And the producer said, well, you can't do that. I said, well, why not? He said, well, that's our work product. We don't share that. I mean, we fight, you know, legal briefs to keep people away from our... I said, no, what if we published them? You go through, take them out, take out things for legal reasons, and you know, and maybe shorten stuff where it's been it's repetitious, but publish it at length. And we did. Not only put up the transcripts of the major interviews, but put up the materials, the underlying materials, put them all together, and in that moment we made our journalism transparent. The second thing we did, and we knew that this was going to change everything, was that this film was potentially, I kept saying, can't we put the film on the web, please? It was 95, nobody knew, but as best we know, that was the first deep content editorial website in history. We made one the next week, and the week after that, and kept going. By 2000, Frontline was streaming the first video. Today, there's 180 films up there. It would be all 500, 600 of them if I was my choice, because I believe they should all be in the public commons, but because of third-party rights like stock footage and others, we can't have them all up on the web, but a good almost 200 of them are there to be streamed there for the future, not to slip through the fingers, but because they are the contribution to the public and to the intellectual commons. And because they matter, because nobody else does these kinds of films. You know, when you take that kind of care and you do look hard at certain kinds of stories, they begin to matter in ways that you didn't actually realize. When we did a film called The Terrorist and the Superpower, we made a film in 1998 about the East India, the East African bombings. There was something called Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. Nobody was really quite sure whether bin Laden would be much of a force after that. He was somewhere in the mountains of Afghanistan. They thought he was really sick and he wasn't going to perhaps survive. But we did that film about the background to all of him. And in 2001, when we sat in the office and watched the towers burning, I got the film up and put it on the screen and we watched it. And I said, this is Al-Qaeda. And I called the New York Times, who were our partners in this, and said, I think this is Al-Qaeda. I think we should put the film up. We should be ready to put the film up. They said, we can't confirm it yet. I said, the moment you do, and in fact, by that afternoon, Al-Qaeda and bin Laden were prime suspects, we put the film up. The next morning, it was a huge audience for it. The next morning, PBS got a call from the White House and said, the Vice President's office would like a copy of the film. And they said, we'll send it right over. And they said, no, there's a car downstairs. So that week, there were screenings with 300 members of Congress and their staffers. It was an awesome responsibility that what we had done was good enough to brief the government. You know, I can tell another story about this, because some years later, we did a film in 2005 called The Return of the Taliban. At a time when the country was paying attention to Iraq, we went to Afghanistan and went and discovered what had happened to the Taliban and where they had made common cause with, in fact, large parts of the intelligence agency within the Pakistani military. And there was, and they were rebuilding in Pakistan. So we did this very powerful film, and then some years after that, Martin Smith, who was the correspondent and producer, was back in Kabul making a film we called Obama's War, because after all, he'd made a stand about Afghanistan. He'd said, okay, I'm getting out of Iraq, but I'll draw the line in Afghanistan. So he was interviewing General Eichenwald, who was then the ambassador in Kabul. He'd previously been in charge of commanding forces in Afghanistan. And Eichenwald said, come to dinner tonight. We've got a visiting congressional delegation. So Marty went to this dinner that night. He said it was like Apocalypse Now. He was on the rooftop of the Kabul embassy with helicopters circling and the city lights around. And he was introduced to the congressional delegation by Eichenwald, who said, this is the man who changed U.S. policy to Afghanistan. He said, I couldn't get the White House to pay attention to Afghanistan and the Taliban. He said, I had PowerPoint presentations that I made to them. I had white papers and representations. He said, I took this film and sat down with Cheney and Bush and Hadley and what made them watch it. He said, that was how we began to then shift our ground in Afghanistan. So the awesome responsibility of actually briefing people on that level means that these films now have a kind of currency that we never really thought documentary might have. You know, I think the old white paper was that the NBC used to call them white papers because they represented the kind of worthy journalistic equivalent of a government briefing paper. This was the important stuff. Nowadays, in a society that doesn't seem to read as much, perhaps, they do sit down and watch, and they'll watch these films. So the responsibility weighs in a way, that when you do set out to do this, you are doing this for the long term. We know that these films go to the War College. We know that they matter out there in academia. We know that people use them constantly, that they have a long tail, and that they matter as their contribution to this kind of first draft of history that journalism at its best can do. And because now, as print really is in such a state of decline, you know, we've seen such an enormous disruption. This thing that we loved, that we saw, that internet that we grasped hold of and got excited about, was also the very thing, by the way, that was threatening to undermine the very act of watching something at some length. And so there's a great challenge to us as to how to maintain doing what we do now, while at the same time people want to break everything up into small little bits and short bits of video that you can watch in lots of different sources. That's a tremendous challenge for us to do it. But at the same time, we've seen this great collapse in journalism. You know, 12,000 journalists have lost their jobs. Newspapers, you know, were undercut, of course. The classifieds were undercut by Craigslist, and so it went. You know the story. You know that the investigative units, which are always expensive, were the first to get cut. And we've lost something. We've lost something quite profound, you know. I mean, corruption hides its face. And, you know, who pays attention to State House and to City Hall and to the other corners of our society does matter. Journalism matters. And I worry so much that Frontline, public television's commitment to this, is one of the few places that takes on the opportunity to do anything at any great length. So it is a privilege. It's the privilege of what public broadcasting has done, and I think there's something very special about it. There have been attacks on public broadcasting over the time, and it's a beleaguered organization at times, but it's also something quite powerful. It has a very interesting, in an age of entrepreneurship, it has a very interesting business model, the business model of membership. This is one of the greatest membership organizations in the country, and it's local, and it's connected locally. It was true when Gingrich decided he wanted to phase out public broadcasting in the 90s. He couldn't do it against the kind of membership of the stations who said, no, this matters. And so it matters even more. Now, in an age where we're going to start chasing after our audience much more directly, to have connections to them, to be able to send them emails and to have direct relationship to the audience, public broadcasting has a very special membership. It also has that we can take into that digital age. It also has a huge level of trust. The Roper poll tells us again and again that of all the institutions in the country, public broadcasting is the highest. And that's profound. You know, people appreciate it. I do believe that we do this because we think there's a kind of civic trust. I think people give to their public television station, they support it, they also know that there is public money in it. And there are arguments along the ideological spectrum about whether one should or shouldn't, but it is interesting to notice that the U.S., after the war, made sure that both Germany and Japan had public broadcasters, that it mattered. Public television, public broadcasting in this country was much pressured by the interests of the National Association of Broadcasters, which is why it was such a weakened organization in the first place, because they didn't want to see a public broadcaster take their audiences. But I say this with great passion because I believe that this is a time where we need to hold on to this idea of this kind of journalism and why we should be doing it. It is, I talked a little bit about the impact. I also think there is something about the quality of what we do which is really important. I think when I was a young journalist, in my first job in journalism, I had a night news editor. I used to go out and bang on the typewriter and do my story, and then at the end of the day I'd put it, clip it together with everybody else, put it in a pile in front of his desk, and he'd come in and read the racing form, and then at 6 o'clock he'd turn the pile upside down and take the first ones off, and we'd sit there and watch to see where your story came out so that you could get out and go and have a beer. And he'd get to my story, and then he'd look at us and he'd do that, and then he'd give it back to me. And I'd look at it and look at him, and I'd go back and look at it and go, what do I do to this? And then I'd rewrite it. And each time I realized I did that, it was my real work of my journalistic education, because what he was basically saying to me was, go make it better. And I did. Each time I made it better, each time I gave it back to him and gave it back, I got better. And today at Frontline, I was telling Sherry that I was on the Colbert Report, and it's terrifying, by the way, to be on with Colbert. And you have no idea what he's going to do to you. He comes loping up and sort of sits down. And at one point, this was the time when 60 Minutes was having a problem. He asked me about competition with 60 Minutes. And then he said they were having the Benghazi problem. And he said they got some egg on their face. And I said, yeah, they do. And he said, well, what advice have you got for them? And I stopped and I said, pay attention and make it better. So that's my lesson about Frontline. It's my lesson about what we do. It's about why we do what we do. And I'm happy to take some questions at this point. Anyway.
As a reminder, please use the white cards on your table. Also, print legibly so that I can read them. Or you can tweet your questions at Economic Club IN. Let me get us started. David, is there any particular agency, public or private, that is doing a good job of evaluating the performance of America's journalistic outlets? Would the Columbia Journalism Review, for example, be one that you would recommend?
Well, I mean, I think media journalism about journalism is actually works in a very local, I mean, in a very narrow way. There isn't really anybody to really take a stock of it. I think that journalism is in a state of crisis. I think because I think there's a very interesting phenomenon that's happening right now, which is I read a story in the newspaper recently that Brian Grazer and Ron Howard had joined together. With GE to do a series of 6-hour-long science documentaries for the National Geographic Channel. So GE was paying these Hollywood producers to interview GE scientists to do this for the National Geographic Channel. You know, so these kinds of new forms of combination of sponsorship and editorial, I think, are particularly dangerous. And I think examining that is something that we need to do and be very cautious about.
Next question. Can investigative journalism survive in the current media business model?
Well, it takes time. I mean, there's much to be said for the rise of the nonprofit investigative journalism newsrooms, like ProPublica, like some of them have been more established. The Texas Tribune is a new example of that. The Center for Investigative Reporting, the Center for Public Integrity. These are nonprofits that have got together to sort of pay the long, slow business of actually doing the investigations. It matters. It matters for somebody to sit down. When we did a film that investigated an assisted living company that owns many, it's listed on the stock exchange, assisted living facilities, had a long record of abuse. And it took a year of examining records of somebody painstakingly going through the kinds of data to be able to put together a film finally. That matters. That matters for the public interest. It matters ultimately to be able to then take it and turn it into something that we offer to the public.
You have gotten more questions than most of our speakers this entire season, so let me try and group these. League of Denial was a book before it was a Frontline film. What's your process when deciding to work with existing material?
Well, actually, it wasn't a book before it became a film. It was a book and a film at the same time, so that we worked in parallel with the two authors. This is League of Denial, a film about concussion in the NFL. And so Steve and Mark, the two writers, were working with us. And our team was actually doing the investigative work with them and sharing interviews, which became parts of the book. And so the book was published and finished right around the time that we were finishing up the film. And, of course, we'd also had a partnership for a while with ESPN, which right before broadcast kind of blew up. And from the higher levels of the corporate parts of ESPN, that they wanted to take their name off the film. And we said, well, if you want to do that and take their names and logos off the film, we said, well, we'll have to just be very public about why that's happened. And in fact, we did do that, and it drew quite a lot of attention at the time. But there were pressures from on high on ESPN not to be associated with the film about the history of concussion in NFL.
Were you captured, sequestered, held prisoner by any foreign countries during your work? And how many times were cameras? I couldn't help ask this. How many times were cameras?
We've been, God, knock wood. I mean, we've never had any of our people actually suffer that way. I mean, I worry enormously. I know our colleagues at Global Post who were in Boston had James Foley was one of their stringers. And I mean, it was a horrible situation to be a witness to. I got arrested in Soweto on my first film. The moment I got the little tiny little amount of money from the Christian Institute of Southern Africa to go make this film about African churches in Soweto, and I had a very good friend who was an African journalist, worked for the Soweto World, called Lucas, and I was so excited I got on my motorbike and I rode all the way to the edge of Soweto and parked my motorbike and walked a couple of houses into Lucas's house and knocked on the door, and his wife answered. I'd only met her very briefly once. Now, of course, this was black area, white South African, apartheid era. I had a bottle of scotch with me, with Lucas, and to celebrate that I was going to now get to make this film. And his wife was there, and we were very polite. He said, Lucas will be back in 5 minutes. And so we sat at the table across from each other in this tiny little room in the little shack in Soweto, sort of being quite formal with each other, when the doors front and back broke open and the police came in and arrested us for conspiring to commit the Immorality Act. So we spent the weekend in jail.
Last question. Is there a topic that you want to do but you haven't been able to?
No, the only thing is that sometimes you want to do topics that are very hard to do because you can't figure out how to get people to talk to you. You know, you can't get somebody to actually tell you stuff that you know something about. That's too hard. There's just too many stories there's always too many stories to do. And so, you know, we get to them. It takes us a while.
All right, I am going to ask you one more. So you noted that the commercial networks have largely abandoned serious journalism, mm-hmm. but so it would seem has a large part of the electorate. How do you fix that? And what happens if we don't?
We don't. Well, I mean, I think we've become a society that is less connected to the kind of complexities of our society. We are more drawn towards the opinions that we agree with. We see that in the MSNBC, Fox kind of division on television and variations of that. And we now know that the blogosphere has, of course, very definitely gone that way, and more people have moved towards, finding an echo chamber for their own views. And that, I think, is part that must be behind some of the gridlock in our society. That seems to be some part of it, that we have far less ability to kind of engage in a kind of civilized conversation. And so we try to hold on to that and represent that. I think public television has a real mission. I think journalism should be at the heart of that mission. I think we should do Masterpiece Theatre, and I love Downton Abbey, but I think we should do more of this kind of work, because I think no one else is going to do it, and if we don't do it.
Ladies and gentlemen, help me thank David for coming to speak with us today.
Thank you.
And because this is our closing luncheon, I'd like to take a moment to also thank the Indiana Convention Center and Center Plate Catering for their hospitality this season. And very important, watch your inboxes for this coming season's full lineup of spectacular speakers, or visit economicclubofindiana.com. There it is. If you aren't receiving emails from us, please add your name to the green sheet on the table, and we will make sure that you are added to our list and be in regular contact with you. Have a great afternoon, and we look forward to seeing you in September as we kick off the 2015-2016 season. Thank you again for joining us, and have a wonderful day.
You've been listening to a speech from David Fanning, journalist and founder of Frontline. This concludes the 2014-2015 season of the Economic Club of Indiana. The 2015-2016 season begins in September. You can find more information at theeconomicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us.